Father Thomas Joseph White is one of those people about whom one can well say that he needs no introduction. Nonetheless, it's fitting to introduce the speaker, and especially him. So I'll just say a few very brief things with the hope that if any of you doesn't know the point, you'll get it, and also to drive up the sale of his books a little bit. So, Thomas Joseph White teaches theology at the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C. He has a DPhil from the University of Oxford. And in addition to organizing this conference, he also manages to write books and stuff like that. So I'll just mention that what I take are the two most recent, The Incarnate Lord, 2014, from the Catholic University of America Press, and a commentary on the Book of Exodus from Brazos Press, 2015. It's June of 2016. There's probably another book coming out any second now. But anyway, available from good bookstores everywhere. And he's going to talk to us about religious freedom in the secular state. So please join me in welcoming Father Thomas Joseph.
Thank you, Professor Gorman. The Second Vatican Council document Dignitatis Humanae makes the following affirmation of natural reason regarding the religious freedom of human beings. It is in accord with their dignity that all men, because they are persons, that is, beings endowed with reason and free will, and therefore bearing personal responsibility, are both impelled by their nature and bound by a moral obligation to seek the truth, especially religious truth. They are also bound to adhere to the truth once they come to know it, and to direct their whole lives in accordance with the demands of truth. Therefore, the right of religious freedom has its foundation not in the subjective attitude of the individual, but in his very nature. In this brief presentation, I would like simply to analyze this very central claim from a Thomistic point of view. How might one offer a philosophical, natural law account of the rights of religious belief and practice through an appeal to the teaching of Thomas Aquinas? Where to start? Well, perhaps following Dignitatis Humanae, we should begin with the nature of the human person. In the Prima Pars of the Summa Theologiae, Aquinas offers arguments for the metaphysical reality of human freedom and its spiritual character. I will not rehearse those arguments in detail. St. Thomas first studies the intentional character of human reason, our conceptual and linguistic form of thinking, and the universal character of our human intentionality. Human beings are capable of thinking in conceptual terms by abstracting from material individuals to obtain to the common essence shared by multiple singulars. We do not only know Peter, Rebecca, and Andrew, but also the human nature that is common to them all. Based upon the abstract character of human cognition, which attains to the essence of realities grasped in a universal mode, Aquinas argues for the necessary immateriality of elements of human thought. Abstraction entails the capacity to grasp what is essential in a given substance in distinction from its material individuality. This means human intellectual knowledge attains to, and in a sense assimilates intentionally, the very form or nature of the things we know. But we do not become the things we know. I may know the very form or nature of fire, but in doing so I do not become myself a being of fire. A material substance can only assimilate a new form by becoming that thing essentially, as charcoal turns into fire by being burned. But we are capable of becoming that reality intentionally without being the form of the thing we know. Consequently, our manner of knowing the essence of other things is immaterial. Intellectual knowledge, meanwhile, also serves as the premise of free will, since rational perception of the good permits rational appetite or rational desire to emerge. The latter is evoked through a series of acts that follow upon human knowledge and that characterize human volition. What we know can in turn become the object of our desire, intention, consent, choice, free engagement, and spiritual enjoyment. Acts of the voluntary, of the will, of the moments in the act of the will. The human being then is characterized by a capacity of free self-determination that takes place through rational self-orientation toward the good. Man is inevitably intrinsically marked metaphysically by spiritual freedom that persists at the core of his being, whether he should wish it or not. He desires the good and cannot fail to seek happiness in and through all of his free acts. As a consequence, Aquinas says, free contingency characterizes his action. That is to say, human behavior is not marked either by an intrinsically inclined necessity, our nature forcing us to choose this or that good. I was obliged to do it, for my nature inclined me to so vehemently that I was incapable of free decision. This is not realistic. Or an extrinsic necessity by imposition or coercion, someone choosing the good for us. This free form of contingent self-determination for the good through rational intention, consent, and choice is not unnatural to man or somehow above his nature, but perfectly intrinsically natural, insofar as man is rational. What concerns us especially about this vision of human freedom is the important role Aquinas accords to the final end of the human person. Human volition is characterized by St. Thomas by inevitable first principles and also inevitable final ends. These in turn give a kind of structure to the free act that cannot be evaded or which is normative for every human person due to his or her rational nature. However, this form of inevitability is very different in either case, first principles or final ends. The first principles of human volition stem from the fact that the human being who advances to the age of reason begins to perceive intellectually the goodness of various realities, and this inevitably elicits a rational appetite for the good. Human beings from an early age express voluntary desires and begin to make rational discernments and choices about their desires for diverse goods, for better or worse. Thus, complex practical deliberation about the good is born, and habits of choosing begin to be formed. Undergirding this process of ongoing deliberation from the beginning is a fundamental prevenient inclination, and this is the overarching desire for happiness. No matter what particular goods a person chooses, and no matter what choices he or she makes, the person inevitably, always and everywhere, wills to attain some form of happiness. It is simply not possible for the rational human being to avoid this basic appetite of the rational will, and consequently the first principle of practical reason is that the good is to be chosen and evil avoided. Such is the case independently of whatever real or apparent goods a human person or a community of persons, for that matter, might eventually settle on as intended goods for themselves. In other words, this inevitable first starting point does not exclude the possibility of grave moral error or wrongdoing, whether individual or collective. On the contrary, it is the presupposition not only of the possibility of virtue, but of vice as well. The inevitability of the final end is of a very different kind, and the analysis Aquinas provides of it presupposes a sustained and elevated degree of philosophical reasoning. It's rather easy, challenging, but more easily achievable to convince people that they always already act in view of happiness in every practical determination of reason that they make, practical reason that they make. It's much more difficult to convince them of a sovereign overarching final end that commands the government of the world, as it were, in terms of what all human beings innately and implicitly desire. Aquinas affirms that the human will is naturally inclined toward the good. Good realities are multiple, however, and there are inherent limitations to the diverse goods the human being encounters in the world. Moreover, each of these goods, when viewed ontologically, exhibits intrinsic dependence upon others for its continuance in being, and this pattern of causal derivation in the order of existence and goodness points us in an indirect but real fashion to the existence of an uncreated first cause. That cause is the primal origin of the goodness of all secondary realities, and therefore must possess goodness in a primal, inderivative way. The goods we come to know and love, then, are participated goods, manifestations that partially disclose but also veil from us the unparticipated sovereign goodness of the first cause. His is a goodness that is utterly immanent to, but also utterly transcendent of, the created world. It can be affirmed to exist with certitude according to demonstrations of human reason, but also remains essentially incomprehensible to our natural human understanding. Such goodness, while real, is veiled for us in darkness. This is one way of indicating what human beings refer to, however imperfectly, when they speak of God. Because the human intellect is capable of attaining to truth not only of finite things, but also of the transcendent reality of God, albeit quite imperfectly, therefore the human being is capable of aspiring to the knowledge of God as an end. And the human being is capable of acknowledging God's presence, goodness, and providence through acts pertaining to the virtue of religion. That is to say, the human being is naturally capable of a genuine religious aspiration toward the knowledge and the service of God in the form of religious thought and behavior. And this remains the case about the structure of our human being, even in the fallen order, though we could heavily qualify theologically through a consideration of the effects of original sin the question of the successful exercise of this capacity in the fallen state of a human being who is not regenerated by grace. Nevertheless, the structural capacity and the fundamental inclination remain ineradicable. For our purposes, the particularities of this argument that I've made previously are not of central importance. What is of essential consideration is that Aquinas thinks that the human will, precisely because it is a spiritual appetite for the good that follows upon human reason, is inherently inclined to the universal good, who is in fact God, and who is alone the objective final true end of man. But this means that the human person is structurally inclined toward God as his or her ultimate final end, whether one wishes it or not, and bears within an ineffaceable natural capacity for the knowledge and love of God. This capacity is ineffaceable because it is inscribed into the very potencies of the spiritual faculties of the person, which tend ontologically toward given forms of perfection. Our intellect is made for the contemplation of God. It is true that human beings can remain religiously indifferent or err gravely with regard to the true knowledge and love of God. Human beings can sin with regard to God as their final end. Theologically speaking, they can even damn themselves to eternal separation from God. However, they cannot eradicate from themselves this structural orientation of the human spirit toward God as the sovereign good and final end of all things. In fact, it simply follows from the fact that the human intellect is capable of truth, that truth is coextensive with being, and that being has an author. So if you believe in truth, and you follow all the logic of the argument, if you believe there is such a thing as intellectual knowledge of truth in human beings, what I say would follow. However frustrated or even tormenting the orientation becomes, even to the point of being eternally tormenting, this structural inclination in us remains inherent to us by virtue of our spiritual nature. Now, it may seem like this medieval vision of the final end of the human person that I've just given is utterly irrelevant to the modern nation state. After all, we might object, most people in the modern world do not attain to or even entertain this form of speculative reflection on human freedom, much less seek to practice a form of religion that reflects such metaphysical convictions. In fact, however, that is beside the point entirely. Aquinas himself presupposes that most people remain philosophically unaware of this highest outcome of human rational aspiration. I'm talking about the natural knowledge of God and the convictions about the final end of man that stem from it. Rather, they often muddle through their decisions about the goodness of created things by knowledge and love of finite creatures that give them a certain imperfect but real happiness through life in this world. What is of central importance is that people do inevitably seek happiness in even their most basic free human actions, and these actions are inevitably open to the objective structure of the good. This structure itself just does have a transcendent horizon, such that the free rational agent cannot delimit its freedom merely to the imminent sphere of temporal and created things, no matter how sublime these latter may be. Consequently, every human being remains, in the use of his or her freedom, necessarily and inextricably open to the possibility of religious self-orientation toward the transcendent God. It follows from this that even in the non-religious or religiously misguided person, the capacity to know and choose has a dignity not reducible to the immanent sphere of empirical things alone, and so the person possesses a deeper dignity grounded in the nature of the spiritual life as such that cannot be merely subsumed into the world of temporal affairs. We can conclude from this that when a government seeks to delimit the range of free behavior so that religious beliefs and practices regarding God are excluded or suppressed from the range of possible choices of free, self-determined activity through coercive activities of the state, in this case, the state necessarily acts against the very structure of deliberative human freedom itself, both with respect to its deepest initial inclinations for happiness and its ultimate transcendent horizon, which is the good in its objective structure. Such behavior is therefore violent in a uniquely interior way. This truth was underscored forcefully by both Pope Leo XIII in Immortalis Dei in 1885 and Pope John Paul II in Redemptor Hominis in 1979. Each pointed their readers toward a common idea. In the face of modern absolutist conceptions of statehood and its function, respect for religious freedom serves as one of the most profound foundations for all the rights of human freedom in general. Why would that be the case? Because the plenary exercise of human freedom in its perfection can only be respected in its essence. Because the plenary exercise of human freedom can only be respected in its essence if the final natural term or end of freedom is acknowledged, at least in the form of a civic right of permission, and if that end is distinctively religious in kind. Only if the exercise of freedom is respected in its complete arc towards its real perfection and with regards to its plenary extension is it in turn truly respected in every lesser instantiation. Otherwise, the lesser instantiations are in fact always blunted from taking on their full flowering in view of and in subordination to the final end of man. In a certain way, what I'm going to follow up with a subsequent argument. If you don't allow people to seek God, in some way you taint everything that you can promote as a good, because you make it always in some way a factor of delimitation on the plenary exercise of the range of human freedom in its arc of perfection. Furthermore, if the final end, the sovereign good, can be excluded by the state from the free deliberative action of the individual, then it follows necessarily, by a kind of political logic, that any inferior created good can be excluded as well in principle by the power of the state. If you're willing to take on God and exclude him, what does the state not have the power to take on and exclude? Human dignity? The family? If God can be excluded metaphysically, everything else could. For whoever can exclude the eternally transcendent and utterly superior can also exclude the more temporal, immanent, and inferior. Setting the state up over and against God sets an ominous precedent as it prepares the way for the state to set itself up over and against the dignity and rights of the human person, the integrity of the human conscience in its search for the truth, and if possible, the natural structure itself of human and non-human beings. For example, the state could come to believe that it could change the nature of marriage, the laws of chemistry, the fact that a Jew is a human being, and so forth. Thus far, we have argued that Aquinas' teleological conception of freedom helps to safeguard an authentic sense of religious and civic rights of freedom. One question that should emerge, however, is whether the inverse is not the case as well. Can the philosophical articulation of God as the final end of man not be employed as an argument of public reason in view of the religious negation or denial of the importance and integrity of temporal goods? One way to respond to this question is to ask, in turn, whether the final good should be seen as in some sense an exclusive good or an inclusive good. That is to say, how does the knowledge and religious service of God affect one's capacity to desire and consent to a wide array of created or temporal goods, and we could say created and temporal common goods, including those that inevitably help to compose the common good of civic society? If I believe in God and am a pious man, with a very well-oriented metaphysical inclination toward the final end, does that give me the right to destroy laboratories? Because laboratories don't matter, or perhaps for all their good consequences, seem to mar the piety of many of those who inhabit them. Or if I believe in God, am I obliged to respect and support the legitimate work of scientists or artists, of philosophers, because they contribute implacably to the common good? Well, the answer should obviously be inclusivist. In fact, the notion of participated goodness, which was invoked earlier, gives an important, perhaps even decisive, help to the consideration of this question. For if the goodness of created things is that which indicates in the first place the reality of the sovereign good hidden from full human comprehension, then the acknowledgement of the goodness of God need not, and in a sense cannot ever, mitigate against the more immediate, for us, epistemologically, cognitively more immediate, acknowledgement of the goodness of created realities. Meanwhile, if all that is created by God participates in his goodness, then there's no rivalry possible between God and the world, for there is nothing in the creation that can add to the goodness of God, and the goodness of the creation simply is an expression of God's inner and unseen goodness, so much so that to act against the structures of created goodness and the intrinsic common goods of created in their created dignity is in some way to act, obviously, against the intention and providence of God. As Dionysius the Areopagite states, in a sense, the transcendent God simply is the world insofar as he is the cause of the world. That's a strange thing to say, and Aquinas repeats it, interestingly, in question 4 of the Prima Pars. Hierarchy and transcendence have to be maintained along with non-competition and participation. This metaphysical realism regarding the creation has practical consequences at the deepest levels of human behavior. It implies that human beings can choose lesser goods in ways that orient them toward more ultimate goods, just as they can choose lesser realities of relative ends that are also means in view of higher ends. I go to the doctor to get well in order to do yet more ultimate things, to pursue the goods of work, friendship, or study, or the worship of God. In this way, without denying the necessary importance of lesser ends, practical reason can orchestrate all things architectonically toward a final end. With the primary good God, however, all actions can be subject hierarchically or teleologically toward that end in such a way as to enhance them from within with the perfection of religious acts. Work, friendship, or study do not lose their inherent meaning, but take on an even deeper meaning understood in the light of God. At the same time, there is the need to acknowledge the respective goods not only in what one might call, and I will refer to subsequently often as, in the ascending order, which I've just sketched out, that you might use lesser things in view of and in the acceptation of their architectonic orientation and practical reason toward the ultimate end, but also in the descending order. The freedom of religious practice is capable of assuming to itself a host of inferior but intrinsically important activities of the civic and domestic, intellectual, and artistic life of human persons and cultures. That's one of the great strengths of religions. But in their historical religious practices, human beings have also shown themselves capable of grave disrespect of human dignity and of other important natural goods, such as scientific learning, the dignity of persons, respect of private property, and so on, stemming from explicitly religious motives. Aquinas terms such religious practices superstition, insofar as they represent an irrational or unethical vitiation of the virtue of religion. The virtue of religion is a virtue in the order of justice, and so it's subject to being a mean between extremes. Those who are indifferent should not be appealed to as negative examples in order to give impetus to those who practice the other extreme of either worshiping what is not God or worshiping the true God in a very bad way through acts of superstition. And so the dialectic between religious indifference or hostility to religion and religious superstition is a dialectic that should be avoided and transcended through a balanced understanding of the virtue of religion. An obvious example of superstitio pertains to human sacrifice, which was widespread in a myriad of ancient cultures, Asia, Near Middle East, Hawaii, China, lots of interesting examples. Likewise, we could think of practices that harm the common good and lives of individuals, cult-like practices, violence or terrorism based on religious motives, religiously motivated suicide or mind control, but also undue religious coercion of human beings who might wish to dissent from religious practice altogether and whose dignity is gravely violated by various forms of religiously motivated inhumanity. The conclusion of these philosophical reflections on the natural right to religious freedom should be twofold. First, the recognition of God that is present within religious activity can orient human prudence with respect to the use of all secondary goods. Because it is inscribed in the very nature of the human desire for happiness, religious behavior is an inevitable part of human culture so long as human nature persists. And it is a necessarily social reality, one that can justly have a public presence within the common life of society. The state or local community should be bound, then, to recognize religious forms of social organization, be they strictly for the purposes of worship, that noxious phrase, houses of worship, or ordered toward more proximate temporal ends, such as religiously motivated centers of education or healthcare, for example, insofar as these ends aim ultimately to serve both the common good of the temporal society out of religious motivations and the religious final orientation of man. For after all, one might believe it part of the religious duty to God to show piety, as Aquinas says, not only toward God but also towards God's creatures through things like education and health care as religiously motivated activities. And these are necessarily social activities adjunct to the necessary social activity of worship of God collectively through visible animalistic liturgy, which is part of the rational animalistic nature of the religious human being. And so the collective social activities of religion are complex and have to be respected by the state just insofar as religious behavior is endemic to being human. Second, however, due precisely to the integrity of the common good, the state and the local community should in principle be able to ask religious persons and associations to respect the natural and civic order. This presupposes, of course, that the state is aware of the structure of the natural law and does not wish to violate that structure. Conflicts arise when there is disagreement about the content of these two principles, that is to say, regarding what genuinely pertains to the order of religious organizations and their right of free exercise, rational religiosity, and what pertains to the goods and prudential activities that the state must defend or promote. We can conclude this philosophical reflection by noting that a religiously inclusive conception of the hierarchy of goods needs to be maintained within any just form of societal common life. This inclusive hierarchy is ascending insofar as it makes way for the freedom of religious belief and practice to orient all human behavior toward God architectonically. We can move prudentially up the scale of goods toward God. But it is always descending as well, since it insists on a respect for temporal goods that are subject in a certain measure to the competence of the state as such as the vehicle for the governance of the temporal common good. Just as respect for the freedom of religion should permit the human subject to orient the whole sphere of created life and society toward God, even in a public way, so also the religious orientation of life toward God should respect and promote the authentic goods of the temporal order and the legitimate free exercise of the political life of a society. Seen in this light, human deliberations about temporal goods and the transcendent goodness of God are mutually complementary and not mutually exclusive. There cannot and never should exist a zero-sum game between the religious mentality and its metaphysical realism and the political mentality in its ethical and moral realism. The transcendent and ineffable goodness of God is understood from the beginning as an end that is to be obtained in and through the pursuit of temporal goods and in and through a public life and society. The wisdom that stems from the public acknowledgement of God is architectonic with respect to the lesser sciences regarding all created goods. The prudence that governs our life in view of God can assimilate respectfully the same political prudence that governs our acts with respect to all temporal realities. And just before I pass to the next and last part, this also is true, mutatis mutandis, not only for political prudence, but also for the search for the truth. So if a scientist were to discover something that were demonstrable, or that could eventually be shown to be demonstrable, for example, that the Earth moves around the Sun. It could never be the case, if this were true, that any rightly oriented or metaphysically realistic exercise of religion could delimit rightfully the knowledge of that truth. Why? Because it's a truth about the nature of reality, the author of whom is God. And so it becomes endemically unjust to suppress the knowledge of the truth, even in some way, in a religious way. It's a religious injustice. It's not just a natural injustice in the order of civic justice. There's something religiously unjust about suppressing a naturally known truth, including a scientific truth. This is not to say that the exercise of the use of sciences is not subject to delimitation. I might discover how to make an atomic explosion. That does not mean that I should be allowed to make atomic explosions anytime I wish, for the pursuit of scientific knowledge. Okay. In the last part of this essay, I would like to turn to a Christian theological vision of religious liberty. In its theological, just to underscore that a little bit more thematically, I'm now going to turn to some theological ideas that are adjacent to and build upon the philosophical ideas that I gave in the first two-thirds of the paper. In its theological treatment of the grounds of religious freedom, Dignitatis Humanae 11 states the following, and I should say in parentheses, Dignitatis Humanae gives philosophical and theological arguments for religious freedom. So you need to think about the document as composed in some way of two parts. 11 says, God calls men to serve him in spirit and in truth. Consequently, they are bound to him in conscience, but not coerced. God has regard for the dignity of the human person, which he himself created. The human person is to be guided by his own judgment and to enjoy freedom. This fact received its fullest manifestation in Jesus Christ, in whom God revealed himself and his ways in a perfect manner. One might summarize the claims being made here in a threefold way. First, God calls all human beings to a life of grace fully revealed in Jesus Christ. Second, the human person, by virtue of his innate dignity, is endowed with personal judgment and freedom. Third, this dignity reaches its greatest perfection in the service of Christ and his mystery. So it's by encountering and engaging in the pursuit of the supernatural end of life in Christ that human freedom reaches its greatest perfection and plenary extension. Aquinas articulates the vocation of the Christian life in terms of his teleological action theory that was discussed above. The human being can naturally know a diversity of goods and can freely order his or her choice-making prudently in view of a diversity of ends. It follows from this, then, that he or she can also structure human life around a given end as a final end. Correspondingly, then, if a human being is newly moved and inclined by grace to the knowledge and love of God revealed in Christ, then the human person can in turn also order his or her life toward the mystery of God as a unique final end. And this pursuit, even if it is supernatural, is not unnatural, for it presupposes and speaks to the human desire for happiness. The distinctively Christian life is ordered teleologically toward the most final and ultimate degree of happiness or beatitude, the happiness of the vision of God, or the beatific vision. In short, the Christian is called to aim in each and every action at the most happy of all lives, the plenary participation in the life of God. Aquinas is concerned to show that such a conception of human ethics is not unnatural and that it does no violence to human nature. In his discussion of the natural love of angels for God, he makes the point that angels and men must be able to love God above all things according to the very structure of their nature, by way of a natural love of God distinct from the love of charity, the infused supernatural virtue. Otherwise, the infused grace of charity, divine love, would be something so wholly alien to our nature as to remain purely extrinsic to our identity as persons. And so here is a quote from Prima Pars Question 60, Article 5 on this question. Since God is the universal good, and under this good, both man and angel and all creatures are comprised, because every creature in regard to its entire being naturally belongs to God, it follows that from natural love, angel and man alike love God before themselves and with a greater love. Otherwise, if either of them loved self more than God naturally, it would follow that natural love would be perverse, and that it would not be perfected but destroyed by charity. The point here is not that all human beings are religious. Aquinas analyzes the human capacity for irreligiosity in some detail. Rather, the claim being made pertains to the very essence or structure of human action, irrespective of its eventual historical exercise in any given person. Just because we are the kind of rational being that remains innately capable of knowing and loving God due to our spiritual nature, the work of grace in us is not something wholly unnatural or intrinsically alien. However secularized our human behavior may be in concrete history, prior to or outside of the workings of grace, there is no human being so secularized, or so sinful, or so negligent with regard to the knowledge of God, that grace cannot act in them, or that they're in the condition such that grace would act in them in some way that would be intrinsically necessarily at its heart violent. This is not true. Likewise, just as we are naturally capable of having God as our final end through the religious service of God and the pursuit of knowledge of God, so the graces of infused faith, hope, and charity do no violence to the human being, but elevate human persons into a form of existence that allows them to be more fully and more perfectly themselves. Charity allows us to regain a kind of previously thwarted access to our innermost selves as beings destined for happiness in God. Catholic Christianity affirms, then, that the human being is capable of loving God above all things in the supernatural life of grace, and in a distinctively Christian way, marked by the charity of Christ. This life of caritas is not contrary to human nature, but in fact heals and elevates what is most profound and best in human nature, our inherent orientation toward God. We should note that the vision being articulated thus far implies a necessary respect for the order of the hierarchy of goods previously discussed in the first section of this essay. We are capable, it was said, of choosing the ultimate good in a religious manner in such a way as to respect the temporal order of created goods in descending perspective. And we are capable of appreciating created goods in such a way as to order them religiously in view of God as a final end in an ascending perspective. This vision is preserved but also recapitulated within the order of grace that has now been introduced. Human society under grace is capable of ordering the world of temporal goods toward the mystery of God revealed in Christ without destroying the integrity of that natural temporal and political order. In fact, we would say, due to the healing influences of grace, at least in optimal circumstances where true Christian sanctity is exhibited, the natural order will be in some way healed and lived out in an exercise of a more perfect regime of a Christian restoration of certain elements of human nature, albeit still in our imperfect and fallen state. And likewise, political society is intrinsically open to the final good that is the gospel and can always be reanimated from within in view of specifically evangelical ends. The gospel is not violent to human political society, and so likewise such society need not be inimical to the gospel in order to preserve its own best integrity and natural practices. On the contrary, the openness of a person or a society to the life of grace serves as a gain to make it, that person or that society, more fully itself and to invite it into a deeper form of flourishing and authentic happiness. A civilization without Christ is a naturally diminished civilization, and even gravely so. How then might we consider the relationship between supernatural grace and the natural religious dimension of the human person, which we were discussing previously? I have argued that the good of religion and natural temporal goods may be pursued in a non-competitive hierarchical way. This is already true on a natural level, regarding the good of religion philosophically and considering it in relation to other rationally discernible goods. This order of ascending and descending hierarchy is preserved and recapitulated in the supernatural life of grace. Grace acts to orient human persons towards a supernatural final end in such a way that it does no intrinsic violence to what is authentically best and most ultimate in human government and in human ethical, artistic, and scientific practices. On the contrary, ideally and in an optimal circumstance, it works to purify and elevate all such aspects of the common good. It follows from these considerations, however, that there must exist for Christian theology as such, I'm sorry, I'm going to stop and say, now listen to this sentence carefully, because if you're theologically averted, you know that this is, when you hear this, there's something polemical and rather consequential being argued here. It follows from these considerations, however, that there must exist for Christian theology as such a philosophically discernible natural final end of man that is religious, characterized by knowledge and love of God, that is distinct both ontologically and logically from the supernatural end of man. The reason for this is the following. The formal object of supernatural faith and hope is supernatural beatitude, the immediate vision of the Holy Trinity. This is something known of and hoped for avidly only through the medium of divine revelation and grace. If there were a uniquely supernatural end of human existence and not an intelligible natural end to human existence, then it would be impossible, strong form of the argument, it would be impossible to argue rationally from the premises of natural law and philosophical reason to the conclusion that human beings have a natural possibility to orient themselves religiously toward a good that transcends the state and indeed the created order as such. The right to religious freedom is intelligible to human reason only on the precondition of the affirmation of such a natural end. Otherwise, one of two things would follow necessarily. Either we would be able to prove from principles of natural reason that there exists a supernatural final end, and so defend by rational argument that the beatific vision of the Holy Trinity constitutes a rational, philosophically knowable, moral right of the citizen, which is tantamount to a form of rationalist error officially condemned by Catholic teaching. Or we would be unable to form any kind of natural law argument at all for the innately religious orientation of all human action towards an ultimate, final human end, because it would only be supernatural. And so we could only give theological arguments from premises of revealed truth for the idea that we have the right as Catholic Christians to orient ourselves supernaturally toward the beatific vision as something that transcends the competence of the state. This, however, this latter conclusion, would stand in direct contradiction to Dignitatis Humanae. Consequently, the only reasonable option is to hold that we can affirm by the arguments of natural reason the inherent good of a religious form of life, because religious action by knowledge and service of God forms a kind of imperfect natural end for the human person. Imperfect only because there must be a yet more perfect, greater perfection to the supernatural end, and it is more perfect to see God immediately enjoy the beatitude of the beatific vision than it is to know God through his effects, through the means of natural reason. What follows from these reflections is a twofold warning. In the absence of a robust concept of the natural final end of man as a religious end, one of two difficulties might emerge for theology. On the one hand, there is the danger that we might lose all manner of articulating in the public square the rational basis for the right to religious freedom. Consequently, theology will make appeal only to a private right of conscience that differs for public reason in no sufficiently discernible way from the appeal to a preferred aesthetic, recreation, diet, or popular entertainment. In a world where there is increasingly little, if any, concerted thought given to the nature of human religious capacities and their metaphysical and anthropological foundations, it is important for Christian philosophers and theologians to pay special attention to the articulation of the metaphysical and natural law foundations for religious freedom and the rational integrity of religious practice. Denial of a natural end of the human person decidedly puts theology in peril on this important front. Second, in a world in which religious practices are often decidedly irrational, violent, and cult-like, there is the danger that all normative religious practices might be seen as intrinsically alienating to reason and the common good. Consequently, the attentiveness to the distinction and interplay of the natural and supernatural dimensions of religious practice is important so as to protect and advance a traditional, rational, and just form of religious belief and practice. That is to say, a form of religious practice that takes responsibility for the common good, for the dignity of human learning in the arts and sciences, for the rights of human conscience and for the respect of human freedom most seriously. To have an adequate theological articulation of these values, sacred theology must make use of an adequately realistic philosophical understanding of the religious character of human persons and of human culture. What I have presented here may seem utopian or unrealistically idealistic. We live today in an increasingly polarized world where secular societies seem increasingly wary of religious subgroups and unwilling to accord privileged status to various modes of free, religiously inspired practice. But we also live in a time when religious ideology of a totalitarian kind is on the rise and shows itself capable of destabilizing the political order at a very deep and constant level. This is the imbalance that Pope Benedict XVI diagnosed accurately in his Regensburg address, the twin dangers that can erode cultural rationality, that of a reductive secularism and that of a reductive religiosity. It is precisely in the face of this void or absence of equilibrium that the teachings of Dignitatis Humanae appear today as especially prophetic. Rather than retreat from the center, we need to address the center, and to the extent possible, to speak from within it. Truth is melodious, and where it sings, rightly and with justice, its voice will be heard. In this effort, if we wish to advocate for a sane ethic of religious freedom in the coming era, we would do well to avert ourselves to the teachings of Dignitatis Humanae and to the metaphysics and ethics of St. Thomas Aquinas. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Father White. My question is with regard to the nature of the ascending and descending movements. So within the teleological order, we made the distinction between the philosophical and the theological, the natural and the supernatural, which certainly bears out certain political implications that perhaps would be distinct from a communio approach. So my question then, because that's the context, my question then, by ascending and descending, do we mean, or do you mean, ascending in terms of a movement of scientia, and then descending as something sapientia, or do you mean by ascending and descending merely a difference of formal object? And then so, and then with that, and this might resolve the second part of the question, but depending upon how you answer that, because you referred to ascending and descending both within the philosophical part of your paper and in the theological, what is the difference? Are there two ascending and descending movements, one natural and then another supernatural? Just what is that?
Thank you. That's a great question, and it touches the heart of the paper. Okay, so just for recap for people who may not have heard this before, okay, Aquinas and Aristotle define I'm thinking about prudence. Okay, it's ascending prudence and descending prudence. It's prudence that orchestrates the relationships of intermediary common goods and ends toward the most ultimate common good that is God, and the superior end, be it natural or supernatural, being God through the formal object of natural knowledge or God through the formal object of supernatural knowledge. But
lean into the mic.
Okay, but the qualification here is that it's a little imprecise to say prudence, because Aristotle and especially Aquinas developed the idea that, you know, prudence is practical wisdom for living ethically and orienting your life toward the true good, living happily, living virtuously. But when you know of the most ultimate speculative principle of truth, let's say about God himself, and thus attain what Aquinas will call the virtue of sapientia or wisdom, that then recalibrates your prudence all the way down in the way you live in everything you do, because now you know through speculative means the highest good toward which you ought to orient all of your life, and how, and in light of which you ought to make use of all other lesser goods and all lesser ends in view of that more ultimate good and end. Okay, so what we're really coming back to here is the doctrine of the two, of the hierarchy of wisdoms in Aquinas. And Aquinas thinks there are three wisdoms: philosophical wisdom, theological wisdom, mystical wisdom. Now, theological and mystical wisdom actually have the same ultimate end, supernatural life in God, but according to two different modes. But the point is, the philosopher who acquires metaphysical wisdom about the ultimate end can then also think prudentially in a sapiential way, about how we could orchestrate all of our lives toward God in an inclusive way that retains respect for all the intermediary and lesser common goods God has created. You know, so he wouldn't oppose rationally, he wouldn't oppose acknowledgement of God, pursuit of knowledge, and service of God to respect for the human family, for example, respect for a certain kind of political common good and a state that governs it, and so forth and so on. Various forms of human learning and the truth. This structure of reasoning is recapitulated in theology in a twofold way. One is because grace doesn't destroy nature but presupposes it needs to assimilate it, in fact, even make a better use of it. You need philosophical, sapiential thinking in theology. So that if you don't understand this metaphysical order, your theology will hobble. It will be frail. And you won't be able to articulate this kind of ascending and descending perspective in which you prudentially, sapientially think about all things in view of God and think about God in a way that you respect all created things rightly. But also, you're now thinking in terms of a theological sapientia, in which you're trying to understand how we ought to make use of all things now for theological motives, and this is where he comes in, you know, the infused theological virtues, but also the infused moral virtues, so infused Christian prudence. How ought I to live justly in the world as a disciple of Christ? How ought I to live temperately in the world as a disciple of Christ? If I'm a political governor and I'm a Christian, how ought I to govern through political prudence in light not only of the natural goods as knowable through the mean of philosophical wisdom, but also in light of the supernatural good of life of community in heaven through the mean of Christian political prudence and thinking about the city of man in relation to the city of God. Okay, so it's the doctrine of sapientia, and sapientia is integrative of lower forms of prudence, political prudence, personal prudence, familial prudence, that kind of thing. And so sapientia can integrate in an ascending perspective and a descending perspective.
I had a practical question. I think you're facing maybe an uphill battle, even among those who agree with you, those who agree with your ends. Y'all have heard the saying, I disagree with what you're saying, but I defend your right to say it. There's been many times in public meetings when I hear people and I think, well, I agree with what you're saying, but I deny your right to say it. What do you do? What do you do, just as a practical matter, what do you do in situations when the majority of people, perhaps, who agree with your ends, disagree with the idea that your ends that you're aiming for have to be philosophically discernible? In other words, they argue that it's based on revelation, specifically the Bible, and are very vocal about that. To an extent, as you put it, it's off-putting and alienating. What do you do in those situations?
Well, I would be worried about what I might crudely characterize as a fideistic conception of religious freedom that only takes its premises of argument from revealed premises without trying to find some grounding in what human beings are and what political life is that can be expressed in commonly understood ways, even for our non-confessional, non-Christian contemporaries. And I, along with that, I would say, while I might not expect a person who holds to a different understanding of religious revelation necessarily to forego reference to that religious revelation just because I make a philosophical argument, I do think that if I make a philosophical argument that shows that they ought to respect my religious freedom, that I can demonstrate to them, due to their human nature, that they are acting irrationally, and that just so, insofar as they may hold that their religious beliefs of in divine revelation motivate them to coerce me in what I take to be philosophically irrational ways, just to that extent, the revelation, at least if they're characterizing it correctly, that they hold to, is necessarily inhuman and irrational. So, I think it's pretty important to occupy the ground of both, the high ground of both revelation and reason. And one of the ways you occupy the high ground of revelation is because you say, well, this is a revelation that also respects the integrity of natural reason and it actually makes use of it in, you know, highly elevated forms to defend through public rational argument the natural good of religion. As for how you deal with it when you have either fideists or rationalists who don't believe in you, the historical precedent is you suffer. Because the two ways traditionally to fight are either you wage religious war or you undergo suffering. And while I don't think that religious warfare is always intrinsically wrong, it certainly has many circumstantial defects to it, and it's certainly implausible prudentially in our world for us, as where the great and early and long-standing way that Christians bear witness to the gospel when they are, what Justin Martyr called the rational religion is refused, is you suffer in witness to charity. And we've triumphed through that, but are we really willing to suffer for the integrity of all that we believe?
I guess I kind of want to follow up on the first question that was asked, but as opposed to talking about the ascending and descending order in terms of the believer, in prudence, but rather in terms of the state. So one thing that you touched upon is religious indifferentism versus superstition. So obviously we want religious freedom because it is natural to us to have this pursuit, but then there will be abuses on both sides. So we don't want to advocate for a just complete libertinism as far as any sort of religiously justified practice.
Yeah.
So what would be the rational limits that we should either recognize, concede, or that a good government should be able to impose on religious liberty in order to protect the rights while not allowing for things like human sacrifice or child brides or polygamy, et cetera?
Right. So that mean, notice that you're now going a little bit toward the classic kind of controversy about dignitas humani, which I'm sure everyone noticed. I just skipped over because I want to use dignitas humani in what I think is actually its contemporary setting, not even the setting in which it was composed, which was communism. I think was a major interlocutor, and I do think that if you go back all the way to Aquinas, but also Suarez, Bellarmine, they give arguments for what religions ought to be tolerated and what not. For example, Thomas Pinkus said it seems to be true that Suarez and Bellarmine argue that polytheism has no political right because it's an irrational form of religion, but forms of monotheism are to be tolerated. That's consistent with the Constantinian principle, because Constantine permitted the continuation of Judaism, but suppressed slowly, and the Constantinian state slowly suppressed the polytheism of Greco-Roman Hellenism. I think it's true that Dignitas Humanae gives wider birth. Now, whether it gives wider birth in principle or in prudential context seems to me entirely disputable. People would tell you there's extremely firm, evident affirmation of universalistic principles in Dignitas Humanae that must hold for all times and all places, and these are absolutely clearly delineated from the prudential calculations of the document. But I don't see that. I think that almost anything that one person can argue must always be the case, as affirmed by Dignitas Humanae, another person can argue. There are some principles here, but a lot of this is prudential and given the setting. So I'm not sure how much traction to give the document on this particular case. I do think that Leo XIII is quite right, to speak in a theological register now, that though we may give criteria from a philosophical point of view of, and should and need to give philosophical criteria of ethical versus deviant religious practices, and that Satanists shouldn't have the same rights in prison as even Muslims, certainly Jews or Christians, the deeper question is really, is it advantageous to have a confessional state insofar as in the fallen world, a state that remains largely religiously indifferent in its official policies will over time, because of the forces that undermine human nature based on our weakness in the fallen world, little by little the state will begin to become an adversary of the revealed religion. And so kind of religious indifferentism won't remain the norm, but eventually you'll get religious confusion or anti-religious hostility. And it does seem to me there are good arguments there from the order of grace that the confessional state is going to typically do the better job. Now, that being said, an important qualification is in place. I like Russell Hittinger's argument that the reason Dignitatis Humani happened was because of Vatican I's affirmation of the primacy of the sovereign pontiff. That's, like, not obvious, is it? But what he shows you is it wasn't just at Vatican I about the fact that the Pope can speak infallibly ex cathedra for the dogma of the Church, but also that he has a sovereignty to determine the episcopacy in all the domain of Christendom. This is important because, of course, of Napoleon, who is designating bishops not sympathetic to Rome in Gallicanism, etc. And so they negotiated with Napoleon that the Church would name all the bishops. Okay, but when you have a concordat, it's always a two-way street. Yes, the state by coercive powers, you know, or by some kinds of promotions of the true religion, gives you all kinds of privileges, but they don't give you that for free. The king, the prime minister, or whoever they are, gets to have some say on who the bishops are. And there are ways that this has traditionally, and the use of church properties and lands, and there are ways that this has traditionally hugely influenced the moral register of the Church. And there are great advantages in having the freedom of Bishop of Rome to determine who the bishops are. You know, this was very important vis-a-vis communism under John Paul II. John Paul II is himself the most important. Okay, actually, there was a concordat, and the communists chose him. They thought the intellectual would be the weakling. They did. They thought he would be more manipulable because of his intellectual character. But the fact of the matter is the Church's fight for autonomy in some ways vis-a-vis the state and the concordat powers, that's another problem you inherit when you have a... So my point is that there are prudential registers also here, and it's not, even though there might be good arguments for privileging the confessional state, there are real concerns about the way that that can then harm the internal spiritual health and life of the Church. Let's take a last question.
All right.
Father Legge will really challenge me, so you should let someone attack me. You should.
Yeah, in the principle of having a good argument, I do want to challenge you. I agree with you on almost everything, as is always the case, of course. But that's why I want to argue with you. And I agree with you, of course, on nature, grace, controversies, and how to think about natural desire for God and such. So this question is about natural religion and Aquinas. You said that the object of supernatural religion, of the theological virtues, is the beatific vision. I don't think that's true.
Right.
In fact,
right.
It's God who's the object.
Right. Right.
Under different aspects.
Yeah.
Depending on the theological virtue. Okay.
Yeah, concedo, I misspoke.
Yeah, okay, so when...
But the orientation is toward... The aspiration is towards knowing God immediately.
Right, it's... okay, so let's talk about natural religion. Does Aquinas really talk about natural religion in any kind of fleshed-out way? So you said that natural religion still would presuppose knowing and loving God as known through his effects somehow. And that's what I'm trying to get my mind around. Is it knowing God as the cause of all things? Okay. Is it the same object as faith? Since it's God, what does it mean to love God as the principle of all things? That I just have a question whether that's possible. It seems that one would be... Are you willing God for his own sake as the cause of all things? And note here that Aquinas, in commenting on the letter to the Hebrews, says that the sort of minimum conditions for faith, of like implicit faith, is that you believe that God exists and that he rewards those who seek to please him. So, but Aquinas puts that in faith as supernatural faith. So what is natural religion then?
Well, if you mean by natural religion some historical exercise of religion that's merely natural and neither affected by sin or by grace, then I don't... But I think you're talking about the natural structure, okay? So actually, the Steve Brock book I signed for this, I think on chapter 6, is really great on delineating delicately what I'm trying to get at on this issue. I think that it's easier with regards to knowledge.
Yeah, but what's the natural love of God? Maybe
let me just say briefly... It's the same subject pursued through natural contemplation, supernatural contemplation, but under two formal objects. One is God himself as known through the medium of his creatures and as understood and contemplated indirectly, But still, we can know truly things of God. For example, that God is good, that the eternal God is good, through the medium of natural contemplation of God, and it arouses in us a certain happiness to know God contemplatively. And Aquinas clearly, unambiguously affirms this as a kind of imperfect beatitude, and sometimes he calls it the imperfect end. With regards to the love of God, actually, I was very careful because I didn't want to meet the objection you gave me, because it's an important objection. And so I actually spoke of the service of God, because I think it's easier to show that even human beings, I do think Aquinas thinks there's something like a natural love of God. He says it in that question on angels and men. But he also says in Prima Secunda, question 109, article 3, on the effects of the fall, that the natural love of God in us, that naturally we should love God in himself, insofar as we know he's good, as he says, the common good of all things. So it's not an abstract universalism, nor is it God just insofar as he causes good things for us, but insofar as we can perceive, he is ultimately our greatest and infinite sovereign good, the common good of the whole universe, just the ways that Professor Long was talking about yesterday. So that's the aspiration, but he says, in the fallen order, we're inhibited toward the aspiration toward that common good, marred by original sin and by malice and egoism and will. We inevitably prefer the private good of the self to the common good of God. And this has to be healed in the human being. But now, that being said, I think he still thinks in fallen human beings, there's enough of the inclination towards religious behavior left in the will that we can recognize some services of piety toward God or some dimensions of justice. This need not mean, so what I'm saying is you can have plenty of religious people who still out there pursue some kind of reverence for the gods or God as they know him, however opaquely, and they're pursuing something natural in trying to offer some, let's say, reasonable sacrifice as they make it up to God or the gods. But they do so, that doesn't necessarily mean that they do truly love God above all things, because to do that they need grace. But when there is grace present, that natural order of loving God above all things is restored. And we can delineate it and identify it metaphysically.
Okay, good. I agree.
Yeah, all right.
We better go to lunch.
So lest the higher good of truth drive out the lower good of food, we're going to have to stop here.
Thank you very much.